We're looking this afternoon in the snooze hour after lunch at covenant quandaries, and our text is Genesis 23 through 25. If this goes too long, you have Reverend Carmichael to blame for it. Last year, he heard me at another conference, and he said I was a bit short, and that people at this conference could listen longer. And so I didn't know what I could do. There's only so much you can do to pad sermons, you know. So I decided I'd just choose long texts, which I've often regretted before, but I thought maybe that would stretch it out enough. So it's inflicted on you. Here we look at Genesis 23 to 25, covenant quandaries. So if you have your text, you might want to keep it open there. Transitions make for problems sometimes. There's a congregation where I'm serving right now has an automobile and truck, lorry dealership in it. A little bit of a problem that the owner had, because he didn't know if any of his sons wanted to carry on the business or not. Now, this is quite a bit of overhead that he has, and can be quite difficult. Will any of my sons, will anyone in my family want to carry this on, or do I have to farm it out to someone else when I'm ready to retire? My own father-in-law had that difficulty. He was a farmer in western Kansas, and his son was not interested in farming, and none of his grandchildren were going to be interested in farming. And what do you do when you're getting ready to get rid of the farm? So how transitions go can be problems. How will these things be carried on, or can they? And that's the situation we have in these three chapters in our text. I'm aware that you don't usually use the likes of Genesis 23 and 25, at least at a conference, but this is the concern. You have two deaths, one marriage, and until a certain point, no births, all of which are problems. So what now? How will things go on? These are the covenant quandaries, and I want us to look at these chapter by chapter today in abbreviated form. Now, the big truth, I think, of this whole section can be taken from the keynote of Genesis 22. You remember last session, I underscored Genesis 22, verse 8. God will see to it, and so on. And so the point of these chapters, I think, when you think of the covenant family and so on, transitioning, if we can use that as a verb, to another member, leader, Isaac, and so on. When you think of this transition, the big truth is the Lord, who has always seen to it, will go on seeing to it, come what may. That's the big truth of these chapters. Now let's look at them individually. First of all, chapter 23, a grave hope. A grave hope, chapter 23. Now let's look here. The covenant family obviously is dying, verses 1 and 2. And so how will things go on now? You have in chapter 23, though, a moment of deep sadness and at the same time a really small, you would say we assurance at the same time as you have this deep sadness. Let's look at the text. The first thing that you see in this passage is a sad event in verses 1 and 2. That gives you the years of Sarah's life, 127 years. Verse 2, then Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. I think it's important to notice that. Sometimes we can get in our reading of Scripture so caught up in what we call God's purposes for bringing His redemption and salvation in the world, some of these big issues, that we forget that there are some very acute sorrows that they have. What this text is saying in verses 1 and 2, and I think it's a legitimate point to press on you, is covenant people have common sorrows. Just because you have a particular position as one of the Lord's people doesn't mean that you're going to be kept from all that wrench and dash down all human people. And here you see it again. These troubles come to the Lord's people as well. Sarah dies. That we're not slabs of concrete. Just because we're Christians doesn't mean we're some sort of impenetrable wall or something. We're not sticks and stones. We're people who weep and cry and agonize over the troubles that we meet. Covenant people have common sorrows. Now, that's the sad event here. There's also a fascinating deal here in verses 3 through 18, this whole affair of getting a burying place for Sarah from Ephron the Hittite. And it's an entertaining kind of narrative. There's a certain urgency to bury, of course, in the Near East. And so Abraham had to, he was kind of in a hurry. And I don't know what your funeral directors, you know, are like over here, but I'm sure funeral directors would get in a real huff if they were aware of this story. They would be come out fuming, you know, and they would hold up Abraham as a sample of those who get in dire trouble because they don't take the early bird specials that they offer for pre-arrangements, and then you get shanghaied into having to pay through the nose to the Hittites. You could see how that could work into a commercial, that sort of a thing. Now, Abraham, though, doesn't want a loner. They offered that to him. You know, you can take any of our sepulchre, any of our burying place, any of our tombs, and bury your dead in one of our tombs. But Abraham says he doesn't want that. He wants a deal with Ephron, the Hittite, verses 8 and 9. And he wants them to bring this in front of him. It's a court scene at the gate of the city and all that goes with that. And so Ephron says that, no, verse 11, it can't be just the cave. It's got to be the field as well. Now, I don't know why that was the case. Some think that maybe there was a problem of taxation, that if Abraham just got the cave, Ephron would still have to pay taxes on the field. But I don't know that much about Bronze Age tax statutes at all. I don't know too many that do. So I'm not sure about that. Ephron wanted, he said in verse 11, it's going to be the field and the cave. You have to buy both together. So Abraham consents. He says he'll give the price. Verse 13. And Ephron says, price. Did someone mention price? What would be a piece of land worth 400 shekels? What's that? It's that wonderful Near Eastern way of bartering. So Abraham pays the money. Now, that's a fascinating affair, and it mentions that it's confirmed to Abraham, verses 17 and 18, and the deal is closed. Now, the thing I want you to see especially here in chapter 23 is this grave hope. That is, there's a thrilling beginning here in chapter 23, and the chapter really ought to get in your bones and thrill you just a little bit on a Saturday afternoon. What's the reason for that? Well, look at the terminology. Did you notice in verse 2, talks about that's Hebron in the land of Canaan, where Sarah died, in the land of Canaan. Did you notice the same phrase in verse 19 at the end of the chapter? That is Hebron in the land of Canaan. In the land of Canaan. This is the land, you see, that Yahweh promised to Abraham. Chapter 12, verses 6 and 7. Now, there's also another note we should notice. This phraseology about, I would translate it, possession of a burying place in verses 4, 9, 18, and 20. 4, 9, 18, and 20. The possession of a burying place. It's a different Hebrew word in verse 18. It's something translated something like purchase or whatever your translation reads. But the concept is still there. So four times you have this reference to the possession or the purchase of a burying place. Now, what does that have to do with anything? Well, if you're connecting to that quad promise I mentioned this morning, part of the quad promise was this whole matter of place and this land, chapter 12, verse 7, that Yahweh had promised Abraham and his seed. And so here, what's so thrilling about chapter 23 is it's the beginning of the fulfillment of God's promise. Does he own the land? Does he have them? No. What's he got? He has a cemetery plot. But you see, that's terra firma. That's real estate. And he's got part of it already. God has begun to fulfill his promise to Abraham. It's just a little touch of Yahweh's faithfulness. Now, you may not get too excited about that, but I think that's the purpose of the narrative, the primary one, even in death. Even in death, the promise of the land is beginning to be fulfilled. And you can sing, even in repressed tones, "Great is thy faithfulness, O God, my Father." It's sort of like, now this is going to date me, I suppose, and it's kind of quaint, but if you can't find a good illustration, you have to make one up. Let's assume that there's a young fellow and a young lady, and he finally got up, this, let's say they're in university, and he finally got up the nerve to ask her to go out to some function. Now, in the States, it might be a college football game. I understand what you call football over here, that's a little more violent, I mean, in the stands. And so you might want to pick a different venue. But let's say he takes her to some sporting event, and they watch it and so on. Then they go out to a coffee shop, and they just sip their cappuccino, and they talk. And nothing fantastic at all. And he walks her back to their apartment or to her dormitory or whatever, and so on. And then let's say, I know this really breaks the mold, but let's just say this young lady drops him a thank you note the next week, comes about Wednesday. And she says to him, "Thank you, for going to whatever on last Friday night." And just in the brief thank you note, there were these six words: "I had a perfectly marvelous time." You know, and then she signs her name and so on and so forth. Well, what will that young man do with that? Well, he'll keep it on his desk, you know, and when he sits down to study in the evening, he'll just flip the flap of that note up and he'll look at those words and he'll look at, "I had a perfectly marvelous time." Now, you know, I don't know how you think of it, but those are just six words, but you know you can go in the fuel of that for 2 or 3 weeks, just sucking it up until you actually have the nerve again to ask her out again. But it's not that she's being too forward, it's just a little hint. There's only six words, but it gives you all kinds of hope if you're really interested in that girl. Now, that's the way it is here. It's only a cemetery plot, but it's part of the land that God promised. It's a grave hope. And isn't this a repeating pattern that we see in God's dealings with his people? Doesn't he still tend to deal this way? Isn't it often in the saddest of times that you receive some small token, some little tad of faithfulness, some minuscule assurance in the middle of your trouble that lets you know that you haven't been forsaken? Indeed, the New Testament, you know, casts part of the doctrine of the Holy Spirit in these terms in Ephesians 1:13 to 14 and calls him the down payment of our inheritance until we acquire possession of it. That is a grave hope. Chapter 23. Now, secondly, let's look at a seed need. Chapter 24, a seed need, or the need of the descendants and the offspring. Now, what is the need of Abraham's seed here in chapter 24? Well, it's for continuity. Sarah's died. The generation, the first generation, you might say, of the covenant people is passing. And Isaac needs a wife. If there's going to be a covenant people in this world, Isaac's got to start with a wife before he even have children. So that's the concern of the story. Now, for one thing, notice that this in chapter 24, all 67 verses, I know we can't do it justice, It is a marvelous story. It's a delightful story, and you should enjoy it when you read through it. You notice, if we could just skip, we'll come back to the first part of the chapter, but if we could just skip to verse 11, chapter 24, verse 11, Abraham's servants come to Aram Naharaim, and he makes the camels kneel outside the city at the well of water. At the evening time when the girls go out to draw water. And he said, Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, grant success, please, before me today, and practice unfailing love with my master Abraham. See, I'm standing by the well of water, or the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Let it be that the young woman to whom I say, bend down your water jar and let me drink. And she'll say, drink. And moreover, I will water your camels as well. Let her be the one you've appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I'll know that you have practiced unfailing love with my master, and so on. But it's interesting, isn't it? Interesting mix that you have there with this marvelous servant of Abraham who comes he sets this, you might say, test up, asks the Lord to submit to this test by which he'll know which girl should be for Isaac. And it's an interesting mix because you have action on his part and yet prayer. He commits the whole thing, you might say, to Yahweh, but he's not doing this back at the Hilton. Sitting in isolation. He's out where the girls are coming out from the city to draw water. And so there's this element of action and cooperation and yet committing it to the Lord. You notice that you have a concrete sign that he makes in verse 14. He asks the one that would not only give him a drink but would agree to water his camels. And so you have a splendid candidate coming out in verses 15 and 16. Before he'd finished speaking, why, Rebekah was coming out, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, who, wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother. So she's even from the right family. And she had her water jar on her shoulder. The maiden was very good looking, a virgin. A man had not known her. Then she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. As she is, and you notice that you have a little revelation of character in this test that the servant proposes in verses 18 to 20. He runs, he asks her for a drink, she gives him a drink, she says, by the way, I'll water your camels as well. Now, you have to convert this back into liters yourself. I can't do it for you, but I understand that a camel, when he's been on a trip like this, will suck up about 25 gallons of water. When he drinks again. Now you've got 10 camels here with Abraham's servant, 250 gallons of water, whatever that is in liters or whatever. I don't know how many times she would have to go back into the well to fill her jar and empty it in the trough. This is a real test, not only of generosity on her part to take the time to do this, but of her industry and her willingness. It really reveals something about Rebekah. And so in the process, he sees something of her character. And he recalls this, you know, in verses 42 to 46, after he goes into the home and meets with the family, with Laban, her brother, and with Bethuel, her father, and all of that sort of thing. He rehearses all of this, of how he prayed and so on. And they say in I think it's verse 50, it's from Yahweh. This matters from Yahweh. We're not able to answer you bad or good. Nothing we can say. It's obviously a matter of, maybe didn't use the word, I don't suppose, his providence. I mean, he set it up. He's engineered it. He's controlled it. That's obvious. And so you always have this servant's response, both both in verses 26 and 27 and again in verse 52. For instance, when the Lord answered his plea and his sign in verses 26 and 27, the servant bowed down and worshiped Yahweh, and he said, "May Yahweh be blessed, the God of my master Abraham, who has not abandoned his unfailing love and his fidelity from my master. I, being in the way, Yahweh led me to the house of my master's brothers." Just the fact that he no sooner sees it come about than he worships and acknowledges that it was Yahweh's doing. So this is the interesting story. Now, let's notice the big issue, though. It's more than just an interesting story. And for the big issue, I draw your attention to verses 1 to 9. When Abraham sends his servant back to his homeland, there are two non-negotiable requirements. One of them is he must not take a wife for Isaac from the Canaanites who were in the land, verses 3 and 4. You can't do that. Why not? Well, probably because Abraham had revelation about, well, he probably knew what the Canaanites were like, but he also had some revelation from the Lord about what was going to happen to the Canaanites. In Genesis 15, verse 16, God said to Abraham that he would bring his people back from a foreign land where they would be afflicted in 400 years. And it was going to be that time gap, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. That is, judgment is going to come upon them, but they're still being given a period before that judgment comes. But Abraham would know that the people in the land were going to be under the judgment of God. Indeed, if he knew the tradition in Genesis 9, verses 25 to 27, he would know that the descendants of Canaan indeed were under a curse. So if he likely knew this, plus he probably knew the fertility kind of worship that they practiced since he lived among them, he said to his servant, "One thing you cannot do, you cannot take a wife for my son Isaac from among these Canaanites where we're living right now." That was the one non-negotiable. The other one was that he couldn't take Isaac back to the original homeland in Aram Naharaim, verse 6. The servant said, "Well, suppose I go and the woman is unwilling to come here. Do I take Isaac back there?" Abraham says, "On no account." Well, what if that happens? Well, Abraham says it won't happen. You see, in verse 7, Abraham revealed his faith about this matter. He said, "Yahweh, the God of heaven, who has taken me from the house of my father and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, 'To your seed I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there." What's he saying? Abraham is saying the promising God is the providing God. If Yahweh promised me this land, then Isaac has to stay here. And if Yahweh promised that, he knows the need we have to have a wife for Isaac. He will provide that, and she will come back. And so that is where Abraham basically leaves it. The promising God is the providing God. So the land promise, the place element of the promise, the land promise meant that Abraham's seed was to stay in Canaan. But a wrong marriage could sabotage the whole thing. And that's why he was not to marry any of the Canaanites. That was the same thing that Israel was told by Moses in Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 to 6, among other places. You don't mix with the pagans. You don't intermarry with them. It'll blow the covenant to shreds. So this was a costly decision for Abraham. What could have been more economically and militarily valuable to Abraham than to make a marriage alliance, to marry Isaac to one of the daughters of one of the local powerful Canaanite chieftains, and then they'd have two clans together? Think of the advantages to that, both in terms of trade and in terms of military punch. But he turned his back on all of that because Abraham recognizes the peril to the covenant in the area of marriage. Now, there's always a danger, you know, when it is things are diluted. I remember Addison Leach, who was a theologian in the States a few years ago, telling a story of a college chess club. It wasn't big. There were maybe half a dozen fellows in the chess club, and they just met and they played chess. That's just all they did. That's why it was the chess club, of course. Well, they got to thinking after a while, you know, maybe we ought to have a membership drive. And so they did. And they got more people in the chess club, but those people didn't necessarily play chess. And they thought, you know, we ought to have some special speakers in for the chess club meetings. And so they did that. But that wasn't necessarily relating to chess. And eventually the club withered and died. Why? Well, because they diluted their whole purpose, which is to play chess. Now, you bring other things in, and it wrecks the whole thing. And Abraham knows that if there is a pagan marriage here with the people in the land, you can kiss the covenant goodbye in the second generation. Now, obviously, Abraham's own kin back in Aram, so on, were by no means necessarily worshipers of Yahweh. They mentioned him, but probably, now this is a hunch, so you need to watch it, but probably they were a milder form of paganism, I suppose, than what he had right in the land of Canaan. But where this narrative in Genesis 24 it's inching toward the principle of Paul in 1 Corinthians 7:39, where he says, you know, if there's a Christian woman and her husband dies, she's free to marry whomever she will, only in the Lord. That fella has to be united to Christ as well. And you don't marry pagans. Now, having said that, and I think this is a principle that has to be pressed upon our congregation so that they're clear about it. But having said that, we have to say, you know, fellows and gals, there may not always be an Isaac or a Rebecca. You could hold to this principle, and you may be single all your life. You have to realize what faithfulness sometimes may cost you. Some of you have heard of J. Gresham Machen, who was in Princeton Seminary and then, of course, at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia for a number of years. Ned Stonehouse tells in his biography of Machen that Machen, who was single all his life, died at, I think, 54 years of age. Machen did have a romance in his life. Not many people knew about it. He apparently told his brother. I don't believe it was mentioned in any of the many letters he wrote his mother. But there was a woman in Boston who was described as intelligent and beautiful and exquisite. And they apparently were very devoted to each other for some time, though it never blossomed into an engagement. You see, Miss S., as he calls her, was a Unitarian. And though she made a real effort to apparently believe in the gospel and in the truth as Machen understood it, she never could quite bring herself over the line. And because of that, since she couldn't share his faith, Machen realized that he could not marry her. And so he went on alone. Well, sometimes there is no Isaac or Rebecca. Now, that's the keynote. That's the big issue here. I want you to notice one other thing, though, in this seed need chapter of chapter 24. And that is that you have a personal touch. When you get down to verses 62 to 67, if you would turn there, this is where they come back. And the servant doesn't report to Abraham. Oddly enough, he reports to Isaac. And you have this beautiful little note in the very last verse, verse 67. And Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother. He took Rebecca. That means he took her as his wife. She became his wife, and he loved her. What else are you to do with a wife? And Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Now you see, I suppose you could say that the big massive issue of chapter 24 is what we could call covenant continuity. Isaac has to get a wife, there has to be seed, and so on. That's the big issue. But in the midst of that, that dominates the story. But you see again, as in the first part of Genesis 23, you have a recognition here at the end that covenant people have common hurts and losses, and that their God stoops to bind them up. I don't know what Sigmund Freud would make of verse 67, but it seems that Isaac really missed his mother. And I don't care what Freud would say about it. But he had an ache in his heart because his mother had died, and apparently he was very close to her. And how was this ache and how was this loneliness filled? It was filled because the Lord brought him a life companion. And he was comforted after his mother's death. I think a lot of the Lord's people have those kind of aches. I remember, I don't know if I was in high school or in college, I remember washing dishes one night at home, when I was at home, and I was drying, my mom was washing. That we didn't have dishwashers then. So there she was, washing the dishes, looking out the kitchen window, and I was drying them, and all of a sudden, she said, "I miss my father." I didn't even know her father. Grandpa Wilson had died before I was ever born. This was probably, here was a 60-year-old woman, and probably her father's death was 30 or 40 years in the past, and all of a sudden, washing dishes, "I miss my father." The Lord's people have aches like that. I remember a woman in the congregation we served in Baltimore. She was a delightful woman, Christian woman. She was a widow. At the time I was talking with her one day, she said that her husband had been dead, when I asked her, 13 years. And she wasn't convulsed with sobs and all that sort of thing at this point, but she said, "I still miss him." The ache was still there. How many of the Lord's people sitting here, have those kind of aches and those losses? And isn't it wonderful to know that the God we have in the Bible, the Yahweh, the God of Israel, and our God, is not only a God of the big plan and of the way the covenant's going to continue. It's not just a big plan, but he's the God of the individual need. And that he gives us forecasts of that day. Once in Isaiah 30, he says, "In the day when Yahweh binds up the hurt of his people and heals the wounds inflicted by his blow." So as Paul Gerhardt says in his hymn, "Give to the wind your fears, hope and be undismayed. God hears your sighs and counts your tears. God will lift up your head." He is the God who handles the big plan and the troubles of his individual servants. The beautiful God. That's a seed need. Thirdly, notice a bleak peak, and that's chapter 25, a bleak peak. I want to notice two keynotes in this section, and this is a bit difficult. Let's look at verses 1 to 11 first. I would just call this a transition. It's another transition time, primarily because Abraham himself dies here. Now, just as a sort of parenthesis, in case you're wondering, he has this woman, Keturah, whom he marries. Verse 1. And you notice she bore him Zimron and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Yishbak and Shua. And Jokshan fathered Sheba, or Sheba as we call it, and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Asherim and Litushim and Litmim and so on, and speaks of the sons of Midian then in verse 4. Now, I think that this is probably a flashback. It comes after the birth of Isaac and so on, but I think probably this actually occurred while Sarah was still alive, probably. The Bible does that sometimes, you know. It cleans up a story, and then it may introduce something in terms of a flashback. If you don't think that way, that's fine. I don't care. I'm just trying to say, in Genesis 17, about verse 17 or so, Abraham seemed to think that he was about beyond being able to help bear a child at age 100. So I would assume that this happened even before the birth of Isaac. But he sent all these descendants away that were descendants of Keturah. You say, of course, was this according to God's plan? No, it didn't meet his plan according to Genesis 2. But was it something that was done in Abraham's culture? Yes, it was. And so here he had this concubine, I suppose you'd call her Keturah. And he had these descendants and he sent them all away. And he gave everything he had, verse 5, to Isaac. Now, the thing I want you to notice is this transition down especially at verse 11, because it contains, I think, a word of assurance for us. Now, it came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed Isaac, his son. And Isaac dwelt near Be'er Lahai Roi. Now, this talks in verses 8 to 11 about Abraham's death, but that phrase in verse 11 came about after the death of Abraham, or simply translated, after the death of Abraham. That kind of a phrase does not occur anywhere else in the first five books of the Bible, in the Pentateuch. This is the only place it occurs, but this kind of a phrase does occur elsewhere. Joshua chapter 1, verse 1, after the death of Moses. And that's interesting because the last chapter of Deuteronomy chapter 34, told us how great, humanly speaking, Moses was. There hadn't been anybody like Moses. And the very next verse of the next chapter says, now after the death of Moses, you can imagine the kind of crisis that must have caused. What do we do now? So this kind of a phrase, after the death of, kind of makes a, tells the, hints at the change of an era. Hints at a historical turning point, even a crisis. So you have it here, Genesis 25:11. You have it in Joshua 1:1. You have it in Judges 1:1, after the death of Joshua. And you have it again in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1, after the death of Saul. So there are these crisis points, these historical turning points. And we ask the question then, what happens now that Father Abraham's dead? Well, you just read on in verse 11. He blessed, God blessed Isaac, his son. Nothing stopped. There was a time in the war for, in 1947-48 in Israel, or Palestine, that the a Jewish contingent of troops, some of the Israelis had taken a village, Castel. It might be pronounced differently, but if you don't know, it doesn't matter. Castile, something like that. And the Jewish men were holding it. I think it was kind of a surprise attack. But then the Arabs, got together and they were going to counterattack and take the village back. They were under the leadership of one, I think, Kamal Erekat. And so they did. They assaulted the Israeli soldiers, the outposts that were, they were in some quarries near outside the village, and they drove them back into the quarry buildings. And the Arabs realized that they had been for 24 hours carrying on without any food. They didn't have any food, so they sent word to the villages, and some of the women started coming with their cries and so on and bearing platters of food, and so they ate. Well, they renewed the attack, and they drove the Jewish soldiers out of the quarry buildings on back toward the village itself, and then they ran out of ammunition. So they had to send somebody around the villages to buy all sorts of ammunition so they could keep up the attack. So they did that. They were within hand grenade range of the village where the Israelis were holding up in the houses. They were within hand grenade range, and Arikat himself was wounded. Well, there was one medic from Bethlehem, the only medic in the whole bunch, that had one first aid kit for 500 soldiers, and he treated Arikat, and then over his protest, strapped him to a mule to head him back to Jerusalem for treatment. Arikat was very upset because he knew what would happen, and it did happen. It wasn't too long that the Israelis saw the Arabs getting up from their positions and walking back to their villages. You see, there were some of these Arab men who were capable of great acts of bravery and heroism when they were led by a man around whom they invested him with an aura and kind of made a cult about him and so on. And when they were led by this sort of a leader, as Arikat apparently was, they were capable of doing most anything but let the leader be taken from the field. And they walk away. Now what happens in God's kingdom when God's all-star Abraham bites the dust and his sons bury him and he is no more? What's going to happen now that Abraham's dead? God bless Isaac, his son. You see, God's servant dies, but God's blessing continues because his kingdom does not depend on outstanding servants. God can use second string people to do his work. Now, that's the transition note in this bleak peak. Let's look at the bleak peak now. In the last part of chapter 25, that is the contrast, and I think this is a deliberate contrast. If you look at verses 12 through 18, you're going to wonder, do we really have to? Verses 12 through 18, and we'll contrast that with verses 19 to 26. Now, what do we have here in verses 12 through 18? Well, you notice these are the records of Ishmael's sons. And if you look at there at verse 13, these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names in order of their birth. The firstborn of Ishmael was Nebaioth, and Kedar, and Adbael, and Mibsham, and Mishma, and Duma, and Masa, Hadad, and Tema, Yatur, Naphish, and Kedemah. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages, and by 12, notice at the end of verse 16, 12 princes by their tribes. So Ishmael has 12 sons. Now, it's kind of a dull piece, you know, of a list. These are the sorts of things we don't particularly find entertaining or devotional, but it's there for a purpose. Now you look at verses 19 to 26, and what do you have in verses 19 to 26? You have Isaac and Rebekah. Now that's all. Do the math on the notations in the rest of chapter 25. Nothing but Isaac and Rebekah for 20 years of marriage, and then they finally have two sons, and only two. So do you see the contrast the writer of Genesis is trying to set up here? He gives you 12 sons of Ishmael and nothing for Isaac and Rebekah until those twins are born after 20 years of marriage. Do you see the power and the prominence and the fertility of the people of this age versus the weakness and the helplessness of God's covenant line? That's the contrast. Christ's people look pretty fragile and flimsy and few amid the success stories of this age. You see, sometimes the kingdom of God is only apparent in its mustard seed form. form, it just doesn't look like much at all. Now, it's sort of like it was in 1958. There was a light heavyweight boxing match. I think Archie Moore, who was 43 years old, too old to box, I suppose. But Archie Moore was 43 years old. I think he was defending his light heavyweight championship from Yvonne Durrell, a Canadian who was 30 years old. Durrell came out and knocked Archie Moore down 3 times in the first round. He knocked him down once in the fifth round. But as the match went on, Archie Moore seemed to gain strength as Durrell tired. And in the 11th round, Archie Moore got his 127th knockout. And that's the way it was on December 10th, 1958. That's not always who has the best show. It's not always who seems to have the most toys or the most power or the most oomph or the most success. Oftentimes, God's people don't seem to have much of it. And I think we need to take encouragement, not that we say, oh, you know, that we use this as an excuse for our laziness or something like that. But don't be overly upset if the true church doesn't seem to be flourishing when she's set, when she's beaten down and nearly brought to eclipse, when she looks like nothing in the midst of the real powers of this age. For God so often does things the hard way and the weak way. So, we don't look very impressive up against the Ishmael clan, let's say. So, what else is new? And so, who cares? So, what should we gain from all of this? Well, simply that the Lord, who has always seen to it, will go on seeing to it, come what may. Let's pray. Thank you, O our Father, that your kingdom does not depend on our might, for sometimes we don't even feel strong. And we thank you that it all depends on the God who chooses and who calls and who uses even weak and second string people and obscure servants to be the channel through which he brings his blessing and his kingdom in this world. Give us, O Lord, encouragement from your ancient word so that we'll be able to go on putting one foot in front of another in discipleship to Jesus. Amen.